My name is Mike Foltz. I'm the 6th District Representative. I also work as Chief Deputy Treasurer at Spokane County. I've been in Spokane since 1974, Eastern Washington my whole life. I've been married for 31 years, and we have 3 children. Most of them are out of the house. My youngest daughter is still in high school, actually doing Running Start. I graduated with a double major in accounting and finance from Eastern. I'm a licensed CPA, and I got my master's in business administration from Gonzaga University. I've also served as a military police officer in the United States Army back when there was a West Germany. A few decades ago. So I've been working in the public sector for a little bit over 20 years, both at Spokane County and Spokane Transit Authority. I've been the state rep since 2017 and seeking my 3rd term.
So how has coronavirus affected your work, both as a county employee and as a legislator?
It's been absolutely crazy. One of the things that I've always enjoyed is getting out and meeting people, as a state representative and on the campaign trail. A lot of people don't like doorbelling, but I love doorbelling. But I think out of respect for a lot of people's views, we've not done a ton of the face-to-face type of stuff, which is unfortunate. Also, in terms of work, even before I left Olympia, we were working on a plan on what the county treasurer's office might look like and how we might operate, knowing that there were going to be some significant changes made. So we have been a lot of offices and a lot of places have been able to work completely remote. We have not been able to do that. We're actually the financial hub for all of local governments in Spokane County. So we approve and release payroll, the files and vendor pays, and all the money comes in through us and we distribute it out to the district. So we split the office up into 2 shifts, trying to protect our staff as best we can. And it's worked out, and we do have a tremendous crew down there who really have rolled up their sleeves and responded to this crisis and have done an extraordinary job. It's been absolutely, I would say, challenging to say the least, and getting this work done and taking care of business on both fronts.
Well, I'm curious about the work at 2 different levels of government. One, you're a policymaker, and another one, you're the one who's sort of carrying out the policy. What about the interchange between the two of you? Have you found that to be interesting? Has it been difficult?
Well, it is very it's very interesting, and over in Olympia there's a bipartisan caucus group that kind of advocates for local governments, and sometimes we shake our heads because a lot of this policy that gets passed from on high doesn't necessarily jive the way they think it do when you get down to the implementation level. So I think it's been absolutely tremendously valuable to have that kind of dual role in looking at these issues and making my voice heard. Whether or not they always listen to it is a different thing. But I think that cuts across party lines. It's one of those things that I think really adds value and really helps out in trying to solve some of these complex problems. Because at the end of the day, when we talk about law enforcement or mental health or K-12 education or et cetera, all these services, public health, it really gets implemented at the local levels. Those are really the people locally who execute and interact directly with the citizens, and it's where the rubber meets the road, as they say. And so I think that's one of the issues that I think we need a better partnership between maybe Olympia and local governments at times.
Well, I want to ask more about that. The Washington State Association of Counties has long advocated for extra revenue options for counties, especially in times when, like during a recession or something like that, when they may be running deficits. And I know County Commissioner Al French has been particularly hot on this. And yet the state legislature, he says, has been really resistant to that. Do you think this is kind of a high enough priority? Do the counties have enough clout to be able to convince legislators to give them more taxing options, revenue options?
Yeah, I do. I'm not. I have a pretty strong record of not voting for new taxes. But if the local authorities want to come up with a plan and an option, I've supported those in the past where they can go sell it to their constituents. For the public good, then I've been supportive of that in the past, depending on what it is and the magnitude of it, and so I think you know, something needs to be done, and I would prefer and have preferred that these local options not only get approved and vetted by the board, but possibly in some cases or most cases a vote of the public to approve the policy to get the maximum amount of public interaction on these decisions. So yeah, in general, I support. The other side of that too is that I hear a lot from county commissioners is in some cases it's not the amount of money, but the flexibility of funds that they already have available. And I ran a bill that actually increased some of the flexibility. And I think it was it kind of intersected between some mental health issues and criminal justice issues, that it would increase the flexibility of existing funds. And that met with some bipartisan resistance, even though I had bipartisan support. So we struggled with that bill for, I think I've ran it the last couple years. So it's not always about more dollars. It's often about more flexibility within a broad category. We don't want mental health dollars going to be used to pave the streets, but certainly if the local experts and the local boards and commissions decide that there may be a better way to better meet the local needs within like, let's say, the mental health space, then that makes absolute sense to me.
So this isn't an issue now before the legislature. It's already been decided. But as if I recall right, you were one of the co-sponsors of the bill to expand county commission from 3 members to 5 in Spokane County. Am I correct on that?
Yes, I was. So that's been discussed and vetted through the courts. I think Jeff Holdy and I signed on to that bill. There was another bill that we didn't like at all. So we went to the prime sponsor on the bill, and he was willing to work with us, and we were willing to work with him to try to craft a better solution, because something was going to pass and we wanted to make it the best bill possible. And that was particularly in light of, I think in the previous year that was passed, there was a change in the voting laws and who can sue over districting. And there was a court case out of Yakima County where they spent millions of dollars and they ended up having to go to district voting anyway, and lost the court case. And so that triggered it. And what was interesting is the local judge, and that's been one of my key points on this, is we got to make something that's a better bill, and that we got to protect the county from this litigation under this new law. Is the local judge, when she ruled on it, actually interjected that into her ruling, even though it was not a specific part of a court case. If that makes sense. So
was this a case of it's going to happen to us anyway, we might as well craft it the best way we can? Or did you actually approve of the idea to expand to 5 commissioners, that it's a good idea on its merits?
Well, I think it wasn't a high priority. It wasn't my goal to go over there and run that bill. Jeff and I asked for, let's craft the framework, let's have a local vote on it, et cetera. And that we didn't quite get that in the bill. So it wasn't a priority of mine. So it really was. But conceptually, I don't think with 500,000 people that having 5 commissioners is necessarily a bad thing. It's we're the last big county that still has three commissioners. I think Clark County was the last one that changed their charter on it. So I think all the big counties have more. I think you get better, you know, better, maybe better representation than otherwise. You know, we have three representatives for you know, 100,000 people we have in each ledge district. So I don't think it's wise. I would prefer that it would have been drafted in a way that it would have gone to the vote of the people somehow.
Well, and it might eventually anyway. So we'll see. So we didn't talk with you before the primary because you didn't have a contested race. So we'll ask you about how do you think the governor has handled the coronavirus situation in Washington over the last 7 to 8 months?
Well, so originally I didn't have much of a problem. I thought the steps that he took early on were probably appropriate. There was a lot of lack of information and a lot of misinformation. But as this thing has drug on, and we're seeing other states and places that are cautiously opening back up, and we're again frozen after months and months. But I think it's gone on too long, and we need to find really a balanced approach, because I'm hearing from businesses all over the place, and we read about them in the paper that are shutting down and going out of business and struggling to keep their people employed, and that can't go on forever. I read an article, haven't fact checked it, but it according to the author of the article, Washington's like top five for business closures in the U.S. right now. So that's not a sustainable model, and so we need to strike a balance between the public health issues and the economic consequences, where people are losing their livelihood and losing their dreams. So I think personally, I thought it would have been much better if we would have had a special session where we could get some collaboration and come up with a plan that would have bipartisan support. I think that would have helped with some of the angst amongst a lot of people out there about on both sides about what we're doing, and it seems like too in working with the county commissioners and others that some of these goals and objectives that keep the goalposts keep moving on what it means, and I think we need to be equipped to respond to like hot spots and locally. My understanding is that some of the recent spike has been centered primarily around nursing homes, and including the one that my mother-in-law's in had a major outbreak of that. So I get that, and I think that maybe a broad brush approach isn't the best. So we should try to get people back to work and these businesses solvent and yet be able to respond and react to these hot spots and these crisis areas. And we can always, you know, adjust plans as things progress. And then we can do so cautiously and safely.
Do you believe in mask mandates?
I not necessarily the mandates. I wear my mask, you know, and I get the argument against that folks feel uncomfortable and don't want to wear their masks. And I think businesses certainly have the right to turn people away. It's a private enterprise. We demand masks at the county. We demand our staff wear masks in the treasurer's office. I wear my mask. I limit my exposure to people. I social distance. But as far as it being, you know, a mandate, absolutely, you can't leave your house. No, I don't support it to that extreme. Again, something reasoned and balanced. But personally, I wear my mask.
What do you think about how the governor handled the unemployment fraud situation back earlier this year?
Well, I think that's a real tragedy, and I'll tell you what, it's still ongoing. I think last time I checked, we still have 40 people that we're working with through our office to get them connected with their benefits, and that's been our number one phone call this year, and is working with people, getting them pointed in the right direction, sometimes intervening and actually sending emails on their behalf to Unemployment Security. And some of these people, you know, it's been languishing for months. Now, not, it doesn't necessarily mean all 40 haven't received benefits. It's just that we're trying to get in contact with them to make sure things have worked out for them. So, but it's still, it's an ongoing thing. And a lot of people, you hear people get their benefits real quick. You hear people languish for months. In some cases, people get their benefits and then get them taken away. And so it's really caused a lot of chaos and problems across the state.
So state law legislators are going to talk also about police reform. And I'm curious, as we talk about bans on chokeholds and tear gas and that sort of stuff, what is the proper level of government for that discussion?
Well, I believe it's local level, and particularly when you're talking about an elected county sheriff, you cannot have more accountability and more public oversight than having an elected county sheriff. Number one, he stands for election every 4 years, and number two, if he's doing a horrible job, we can get together and recall him if we deem that necessary. So we can go out and fire the sheriff if we don't approve of what he's doing. That's certainly not the case. I think our sheriff does a very good job in what he does. So I think that should be local control. There's some of it, you know, chokehold. I was actually an MP in the Army, and this was in the 80s. And I will say they probably trained us in far more aggressive tactics than what are deployed today. You know, we had a nightstick and we had a 45, and that was our use of force options, other than, you know, interpersonal communication and talking to folks. So it was a whole different mindset that has greatly evolved. And I will tell you, I went in as an MP thinking I wanted to do law enforcement. I did it for a while, decided no, thank you. So it is a tough job, and you know, and I support law enforcement. I don't think defunding the police is right, and I think that they're you know, fully aware of the stuff. And I think, you know, particular to chokeholds, it's different when you're in a life or death situation. And if you read about some of the, you know, the fight or flight things, that law enforcement's subject to that too. But I think in a lot of cases, I think the some of those holds need to be evaluated, but ideally at a local level. And I know the sheriffs and chiefs of police work together collaboratively to develop standards. And I think that work is ongoing as we speak. And so I look forward to seeing what we can work out. But you know, tear gas, I think it serves its purpose. And when you have looting and rioting, I think you need to do something to protect lives and property.
Do you believe in the concept of systemic racism as it comes to police and people of color?
Well, I've heard, you know, I'll just give you my thoughts on it. Do I think that there's absolutely undeniable evidence that when you look at the outcomes of our criminal justice system, that it is heavily the outcomes are there. The bottom line is there's more black males in prison disproportionately. That is an unarguable fact. So something is wrong in the process. And you know, I have a hard time. I've heard different definitions of the term systemic racism. To me, I don't think that every cop, every judge, every prosecutor, every defense lawyer, et cetera, are all racist. But I do think that what we need to do, and part of what I do in life, I'm certified lean management, Six Sigma stuff. And one of the things we always look for is root cause. When you have a problem, you look at the symptom and try to find out what the root cause is. And I think part of the root cause is, you know, the police do what we tell them to do and what laws to enforce and how the severity of the law. So I think we need to look at maybe some of these nonviolent crimes on the level of criminality of some of those. I think we certainly need to look at the 1994 crime bill, which is a federal issue, and the a lot of what we're dealing with stems from that. So I think we do need to look at some of these nonviolent crimes and the level of aggression, you know. So I think that's part where the discussion goes. I think I think, you know, prison reform and sentencing reform is also part of that. And then how do you take the stigma away on some of these lesser offenses? Because, you know, once you're a felon, always a felon, and it's hard to get out of the pipe, and you become a career felon. And in a lot of these cases, these individuals start with very minor crimes, and but there's really no way out, and that escalates, and then they're lifetime felons. And so we need to change how we address that early in the process, and rather than trying to just, you know, broad brush it, tackle it at the end. So I think yes, it's a real thing. And when you look at the outcomes, I'm kind of a data driven guy, so you can't argue about the facts, and the facts are clear.
So you deal with money every day, and I want to ask you about a couple of budget-related issues with regards to the legislature. One is we have this year of all years figured out that public health is a pretty important thing, and yet the public health folks say we don't have enough dedicated funding sources to do our work. Do you think the legislature will go back in 2021 and try to figure out a way that public health has more of a sustainable revenue source?
Hopefully, and I would loop in mental health on that. And I think the two go hand in hand, and actually the mental health and the pub ties into criminal justice too, because as we know that the jail becomes a clearinghouse for a lot of mental health people with mental health issues. So I think they're all interrelated when we look at that. And so I think you know, before we left session, I voted for a bill that put $200 million into the public health in response to COVID. But I think we do need, to me, that's a kind of a core service of government. And again, that is, to me, where we need to look at that partnership between state and local, because we have our local public health office. And, you know, there's been some criticism and there's been some good that has come out of some of the discussions around that. But they're the ones that are really implementing it. They're the ones with the staff that meet with the people. They actually, you know, in a lot of cases, know where these people are, or know where these people should be. So they're the ones that know. So I think that ties in with strengthening, enhancing, developing this state and local partnership to help execute that. And again, it's not always about more money. It's about maybe more flexibility. But hopefully we take a good look at it. But it's at least reasonably adequately funded, I think, in the near term. So, but I think you're right. There's always sustainability issues on the funding source. We don't, you know, at county government, we just don't get the option to, they can't go out and just create a new tax out of whole cloth and go forth and conquer to balance their budgets.
Well, maybe there's another thing for counties in the state to talk about. The second area is in wildfires. And, you know, we were looked like in through August, like we were going to get off fairly easily this year. And then Labor Day rolls around and then we were socked in smoke for a week and a half. So the lands commissioner has pitched a little $10 surcharge or $12 surcharge, whatever it is, on insurance premiums to help pay for a wildlife stabilization fund. Is that something you can go along with?
So I got an easier solution. Let's manage our forests. You know, we can do responsible logging and management of our forests, which actually has a threefold benefit. It helps increases the health of the forest, and with it, and I'm not talking about, you know, clear cutting like the olden days, but I think responsible management of the forests is the way to go, because it lessens the severity of the fires. It increases the health of the forest. A second, it creates jobs in some of these communities where logging used to be a key part of it, of their local economy. And third, there's a little known tax out there, and it's called the timber tax. And that money gets actually directed, at least last time I checked, to K-12 education, where if you go in, you log, you pay a stumpage fee, a certain amount of money that goes into money that goes in K-12 education. The problem I have with these surcharges and these special funds is, in Olympia over the years, what they have done is they have actually looted those funds and thrown the money into the general fund. They create these funds for a specific purpose, create a specific tax, and then take the money and use it for other purposes. And I'll point to it's called the the MTCA. It's the Model Toxic Control Act. And there's a special fund in Washington State that's meant for environmental hazards. They've taxed people on a couple things, put the money into a big pot, and that's supposed to be used to clean up these environmental areas and make the environment better and safe. And what they end up doing is sweeping the money and looting it. So anything like that, I would say it would have to be ironclad, locked up tight. No way you can touch it. And I think that should apply to all of our existing, these existing special revenue funds. So,
yeah, point taken. I guess my point is that even, I mean, DNR is already doing a lot of some of these sorts of sales that you're talking about, and even working with the Forest Service in areas where the jurisdictions overlap, but it still costs a lot of money to plan the sales and actually go out and cut them and then go ahead and sell them. And so, it's and a lot less. There isn't enough money to be able to cut enough to be able to do a pretty good job of covering the landscape that you really need to cover. So a lot of money is still going to be needed. And so I guess I'm saying that Hillary Franz will come out and argue for more money.
Yeah, well, I will take a look at the proposal, and if it makes sense and it's safeguarded and it's not going to be redirected, I mean, I think it's an important issue. You know, it is kind of it's kind of frustrating. I can't remember the number they spent on orca whales, which is important, but we have an immediate need on forest fires, and I think it only ended up being a 20-30 million, something like that. But I do think I think there could be a balanced approach that maybe we can expand some logging and get some private companies involved in the process, expedite the process, and yet maybe sequester some very dedicated and specific funds solely for the purpose of keeping these fires down. Because I got to tell you, I have moderate severe asthma, so there is nothing more I dread than our fifth season now, which is smoke season. So I absolutely get it. I think it's important. I enjoy going to, you know, the outdoors and camping and stuff. And we need to do everything we can to help preserve our wonderful natural resources.
So let's finish with this. You're asking people for their votes, and I'm curious, you as a voter, when you get your ballot, what are the qualities you look for in candidates, and how do you decide whom to vote for?
Well, experience, I think, and it depends on the level of government and what I'm looking for. But I think experience matters to me. I think what you've done in life and in your role matters. I think what issues are important to you matter. So I think those are the key issues that I really look at. You know, and of course, you know, most of us pick a party. So I think that weighs in, but that generally is not, you know, necessarily the single most overriding, factor in this, especially on some of these more local races.
Yeah. Mike, anything I didn't ask about that was important to you before I let you go that you wanted to talk about?
Well, let me think. Give me 5 minutes and I'll have a long list of it. But as soon as we hang up. No, I thought it was a very good interview, and I always enjoy talking to you. I think you have a very fair and reasoned and honest approach to this. So
thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.